Welcome to Truest Blood, the official True Blood podcast.
I'm Kristen Bauer.
And I'm Deborah Ann Wohl.
And you've been invited in.
I want to do bad things with you. On Truest Blood.
Welcome back to Truest Blood, where we sink our fangs into the series, episode by episode.
It's episode 208, Dev. Can you believe it? Entitled Time Bomb, written by Alexander Wu and directed by John Dahl.
Now, our players sort of face off this week as conflict comes to a head, but it's none other than a 2,000-year-old predator pleading to keep the peace. Mm-hmm. Plus, we share perhaps a little too much information about vampire regeneration.
And then it's off to the races with the marvelous Michael McMillan. His shrewd performance as Reverend Steve Newland is equal parts totally hilarious and also thought-provoking.
Yeah.
You'll know him from all over your TV set. Shows like What I Like About You, Hot in Cleveland, and Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. He also writes comic books and has two exceedingly entertaining podcasts.
Ugh, I mean, he is a never-ending font of creativity, and we cannot wait for you to hear this interview. But first, this week on True Blood.
And we're back in the church basement where Godric easily snaps the neck of Sookie's assailant. Eric appears and Godric orders him and Sookie to leave the compound without any more bloodshed. Unfortunately, they are outnumbered and it is now Eric who becomes Steve Newland's sacrificial vamp.
Brothers and sisters, there will be a holy bonfire at dawn.
Luckily, Godric and a whole army of vamps show up just in time to turn the tables, including Jason, who, after being shot twice by Sarah with a paintball, has reconsidered his loyalty to the Newlands.
In the hotel, Lorena is momentarily distracted by Barry the Bellboy's intoxicating blood, and Bill finally gets the jump on her with a 52-inch plasma TV to the head.
Everyone says they're so thin and light, but let me tell you, when wielded properly, it's quite a weapon.
He heads off to join the battle at the Fellowship, but not before barging in on Hoyt and Jess mid-coitus. He orders them back to Bon Temps, where, hormones raging, they go for it again, only to discover Jessica's vampire healing has created a bit of a barrier.
Bon Temps remains Marianneville, as Sam is booked for the murder of Daphne, and Taryn Eggs go all WWE on each other after Marianne cooks them a mystery meat souffle.
Well, damn. What is in there? Is that the rabbit you caught?
Among other things.
But no one is eating at the light of day church, not even the vamps, as Godric pleads with all for a peaceful resolution. Steve Newland refuses, but his mob senses defeat, and amazingly, the conflict ends without further death.
Later, the vampire set is celebrating their victory at Shea Godric, yet the man of the hour remains uneasy. Godric continues to lament the violent tendencies of vampires while showing mercy to traitors like Hugo. Lorena makes an appearance, stirring up trouble with Sookie, and Godric has Bill escort his maker out. Just then, a mysterious visitor enters the room, his vest wrapped in silver and stakes and a bushel of C4.
My name is Luke McDonald. I'm a member of the Fellowship of the Sun, and I have a message for you all. I'm Reverend Steve Newland.
And he presses the detonator. So, Kristen, this one's exciting for me. It feels like everyone is squaring off in this episode, like boxers. They're in, like, their separate corners, kind of sizing each other up. Yep. So, yeah, I think, you know, we can start with, like, the macro of fights, which feels like Steve versus Godric, which is practically an ideological fight.
Well, it's so funny because Godric is the one fighting for peace and love your brother, which is Jesus's whole thing, right?
Right.
So Steve is like, Jesus will protect me. And then Godric says, I'm older than your Jesus. I wish I could have known him, but I missed it.
Yeah, but I missed it, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's love, this idea of like radical acts of peace,
yeah,
right? Like world challenging acts of peace. And there are so few people in the world that are capable of that. You know, I think of Gandhi, you know, I think of Martin Luther King, you know, these people who do incredible things that change our world.
Yeah, the Dalai Lama.
Yeah. And, you know, so here we have Godric trying to do that. Mm-hmm. And he's in a position of power, which makes that easier for him to do. But, you know, but he's surrounded by people with high emotions and a lot of violence in them. Mm-hmm. It's a really fascinating scene to see him try and wrangle that.
It is. And, you know, it is funny because we say he's in a position of power, so it is easier when you're not, you know, when you have choice. But yet people in power, we never see exercise it. So absolute power corrupts absolutely, right? It's right. We never see that. When people can, they don't seem to choose that high road. And we see his evolution. It took him 2,000 years or more to get there. But it really does take courage for all of us to forgive people we think have wronged us or have wronged us. It's hard.
Yeah. Well, you know, and we'll be talking with Michael later today. And you know, Michael brought up this idea that while within genre we are talking about things from the real world, vampires are not a one-to-one correlation, right?
Right,
like,
right.
You know, vampires do some pretty terrifying things. And in fact, I think Godric puts it really well.
Let's be honest. We are frightening. After thousands of years, we haven't evolved. We've only grown more brutal. More predatory. I don't see the danger in treating humans as equals. The Fellowship of the Sun arose because we never did so.
Ugh. Yeah. Alexander Wu. He's just...
I mean, yeah.
Nailed it.
Alex really knows how to... how to pull apart an idea and show you all of its flaws and also, you know, virtues. It's really incredible. But I mean, you have this huge scene in this church. It took them 3 days to shoot it. They were outside of town in a small place called Whittier. In fact, I think we heard they made t-shirts, the girls are prettier in Whittier or something like that, because they were all stuck there for a week. But it's this incredible, I mean, that set to start with. I mean, that it's not a set, you know, it's an actual incredible church who probably had no idea.
Yeah, who clearly didn't watch the show.
There.
Yeah.
We have Michael in this amazing white suit
with the green paintball splotch on his forehead. Oh my gosh, I love him so much. We all love him.
Just love him so much. And he still manages to ground it, right? Like he's doing this whole scene in this ridiculous suit with this ridiculous green splotch on his forehead.
Yes.
And yet, when Stan comes in and says, "We killed your parents," and he blood-curdling yells, "Murderers," and my heart breaks a little bit for him.
I know.
Knowing that he was going to kill all of them.
Yes.
You know, as well, that he has it in him too. So it is so complex.
It's so complex. It really, life is lived in the gray areas, right? Yeah. It's not black and white. And I think this show, these writers, these directors, and then the cast.
Yeah.
Really, wow, incredible how that all came together.
Yeah. When I want to give a shout out to Valerie Crews as well here. She's the actress who's playing Isabel.
Yeah.
And again, it's a really lovely, very not cliched take on a vampire, right?
She's very not cliched.
Feels very human and emotionally connected. And in any ways, like the most evolved vamp. She feels more evolved to me than Godric in some ways because she still is allowing herself to like live in this present moment. But what she deals with what happened with Hugo and admitting that she still loves him even after what he's done.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, I know that scene.
It's so beautiful.
It's so beautiful. She's so good.
Yeah, she's spectacular. I'll also mention as the aside, those 3 days in Whittier is where Alexander Skarsgård and Michael McMillan became best friends.
Yes. Yes.
Spending all that time together because they had not met before. But yeah, they're a pretty good team off screen as well.
Totally. 3 days in a scene in a room with either one of them, you just want to know them forever.
Yes, for sure.
I experienced it with both of them.
So then the other pair up we have here is Eric and Bill.
Yes.
So we get back to Godric's and there's this party going on and I'm watching the whole thing and they're fighting over Sookie. And it's just like, it's like watching them fan their peacock feathers and just try to claim her for their own.
Totally. It does make you think of like dogs in a park, you know?
Oh my God.
Right?
It's really sort of ridiculous. But I do enjoy, Eric seems to get a lot of enjoyment out of the fact that he fully knows how much power he has over Bill.
I know. I like how, I mean, it helps that he's just a great actor, but also he's really tall. So yeah. There's kind of a looming over people where he just says stuff and then observes them. Alex in the commentary said that Eric enjoys watching people's reactions to his presence.
Yes. I think that's really clear. And there are moments in the episode where they've also helped orchestrate the background actors and people around him. Like at some point he walks in to where Godric is and everyone just leaves. You know, he just has to nod his head. And so that can help a lot for an actor when a director and everyone kind of gets on board to help sell the power that you carry.
Yes.
You know, that tells us a lot about a character.
Yeah, because it is interesting how Godric and Eric and so many have commented, you know, the director commented in the commentary about how Godric shows his power. He's a little guy, but he shows his power by being so still and underspoken. Mm-hmm. And Alex/Eric are really good at that too.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, definitely. But it's interesting, you know, I think also for Sookie, this whole experience, because she hates Eric, right? Everything he is, and you know, but she's starting to see kind of the softer side of Sears here, and he's showing her his vulnerable side towards Godric, towards her. He has this interesting line I really love, actually.
He's your maker, isn't he?
Don't use words you don't understand.
You have a lot of love for him.
Don't use words I don't understand.
Yeah, and there's
he's
a
trying
moment.
To hide it.
Yeah, he's trying to hide it. He's trying to hide it. And it's such a brilliant line with what's coming up, right? His complete vulnerability with Godric's leaving.
And, you know, as we come into that, it's again another thing Sookie is going to witness that goes a long way towards sort of turning her mind around about him.
Yeah. And Steven, who is a director and has always been an actor that thinks like a director, which is why he became a director, he comments in the commentary about this moment where Eric and Sookie get close together, you know, proximity wise, inches apart, is the first kind of moment that leads to what we see coming up, you know, in this year and then future years.
Yeah. I mean, you know, physicality, of course, is a great actor tool that helps tell a story to everyone else, but also puts you, you know, proximity to another person can change how you feel in the moment. It can just affect your chemistry, you know, your biology, literally. And it can be a very effective tool to sort of bring out feelings.
Yeah, and the viewer's feeling it because the camera's in close, right?
Yeah, but the boys are not the only ones facing off over Sookie. We have Lorena and Sookie in their corners duking it out over Bill.
Yeah, and again, Sookie doesn't watch the show because she completely... attacked, like, is like, thinks she can, like, fight Lorena.
Super provokes Lorena. Now, Lorena sort of started it, too.
Yeah.
But, yeah, she's, Sookie is just full of spitfire.
Totally. She's like a chihuahua taking on a German shepherd.
Amazing. And I want to talk a little about the costumes in this, because we have Sookie in this white coat, which I don't totally follow the logic of why she's in it.
Right.
But it's great, because in contrast with Lorena's, like, bright red dress. I mean, they really look like sports uniforms. Like they look like, who are you rooting for? Oh, the red team, you know, like.
Right. That's kind of so thing. Funny.
It's really, really striking. And then they do these two shots of Lorena that I want to give credit to our, you know, the cinematographer this episode and also John Dahl. When Lorena first enters, she's in the far background behind Sookie and they have this spotlight on her. And it's like everyone fades in that room except for her. It's really great storytelling, I feel.
Yes.
And then I noticed when Lorena and Bill have left the party and Bill's in the foreground facing out and Lorena steps up behind him and she's crying. And to me, it looked just like the shot when they're outside of Bill's house back in the 1860s. Yes. And he's saying goodbye to his family. Only now she's the one crying.
Oh, that's a good callback, Deb. Good memory.
I mean, whether it was intentional or not, it just, because we're watching it in succession, I really saw that parallel.
Yeah.
And the shift in their power in some ways.
Yeah. Ooh, that's another really good Bill Lorena, amazing, heartbreaking scene.
It really
is. When will we see each other again? Never.
Yeah, never. When she has this line earlier, it's from, we'll start with Bill's.
Is this your maker?
She released me years ago. She no longer has any hold over me.
Oh, I wouldn't say that. We had two marvelous nights in your hotel room.
What?
You know, I think Lorena really does know him better than he gives her credit for.
Mm-hmm. She knows the history, right?
Yeah.
Sookie knows the guy that she met today, which in all fairness, I guess is true for all of us when we meet someone. Should we really be still the idiot I was when I was 16, you know?
Yeah.
But she has seen the full arc.
Yeah. You know, Bill, as far as we know, has not shared this history with her. He has vaguely said that he's done some bad things, but, you know, I don't think her imagination is really catching up to reality.
Yeah, the flashback.
And Lorena knows.
Right, where they're having, like, they killed the people and then having sex, rip the necklace
in
off.
Blood.
That Lorena is wearing in that moment.
I don't think Sookie's imagining that. He says he's done bad things.
That might be a quote-unquote boner killer, you know?
Yeah, just might. What is not a boner killer, however, surprisingly, is this insane fight with Tara and Egg.
It was so insane.
Crazy.
I mean, what?
This is a WTF kind of moment on this show.
Yeah.
And I think John Dahl shared that he and Alex both had a moment like, is this too far? Have we crossed our True Blood line yet? And they went for it. And it is a genuinely sort of uncomfortable scene.
It is. It's uncomfortable and perfect.
Yes.
So it's bizarre. And that thing, that might be a theme we should keep up.
Yes.
Have we gone too far?
Too far.
We were continually, when I'd get the script, when I was in a wardrobe fitting where Audrey would be adding bigger earrings, have we crossed the line? And
have we yet?
Have we yet?
Or do we just keep pushing that line?
We keep pushing
further,
it, you know? And will we know when we cross it? You know, because we're living in this world, right?
Right. And if you cross it, can you come back? Probably. I don't know.
Yes. We
but
never
part of
really
why I
knew
think this moment that it can creep you out and be funny and be hard to watch and be kind of brilliant is actually the 100% commitment from every single person involved in that scene.
That's it. You could not do it 80%.
One of them holds back.
Yes. And that is why we as audience members ride along.
Right, because in a way, the acceptance of the actors and the characters in that moment invite you to kind of go, all right, I'm going to step into this uncomfortable zone and see how I feel about it. And it really, I think, exposes the danger of marrying.
Yes. And her back there and relishing really sells it.
Boy.
Right, because they are under the influence. And the fact that after he hits her the first time, we all go, and
oh,
then
my
how
God.
Rutina, Tara is like, yeah, she laughs and goes, do it again.
Yeah.
Oh,
and,
it's
and
crazy.
It leads into this very complex feeling that they have. But to also offer a tidbite, to use Kristen's they said that pie was mostly apples and sort of those kinds of thicker fruits, and that they used a lot of sort of red food coloring and stuff. It was very important. They wanted to keep it that bright red blood color. And so, you know, something to know about Alexander Wu, the writer of this episode, is that he's a gourmand. He loves good food. Yeah. He can always tell you where the best restaurant is. And this cooking scene was very important to him. And on that note, now for a quick bite of Hunter's souffle.
Well, howdy, y'all.
Welcome to our humble kitchen.
We're going to be rustling up some real good eats for you today. So first of all, you'll need to gather all your veggies, carrots, celery, onions, potatoes, all peeled and diced, and your spices, salt, pepper, garlic powder, rosemary, and thyme, all to taste.
Then you're going to want to brown all that up in a hot skillet with a heap of melted butter. This is the South, after all. Then hit it with a splash of cognac. We won't tell.
Does that sound good already?
Well, hold that thought, because we still need the meat. Now, you can use rabbit, sure, among other things.
Venison is traditional, and beef or minced lamb would give it a European flair.
But we recommend the heart of a shape-shifting zealot. It is the tenderest.
Shapeshifter is optional. If that's not available in your area, you can use a regular old human heart.
Now, you listen to me and you stir that all up till it's browned and cooked through. Then you add your Worcestershire and stock. Let it boil till it's nice and thick.
If you lose the deep red color, just throw in a little ketchup. We don't stand on ceremony here.
Finally, fill an unbaked pastry crust with the blood red mixture and be sure to cut some slits on the top for venting. We don't want no soggy bottoms now, you hear?
No, we don't. Then you bake it until the crust is nice and brown.
It is face smacking good.
Whoops-a-doodle, I think you meant to say lip-smacking.
What'd I say?
Face-smacking.
Well, silly old me. So this week I thought it might be fun and horrifying to talk about vampire regeneration.
Yeah.
Specifically my own, which we'll get to in a little while here. But, you know, I thought we might start with, like, remembering what we know about vampires and their anatomy and how their body and healing works. So, you know, we had learned in the first season, Bill shares with Sookie, that vampires have no heartbeat, no brain waves, no electrical impulses. They don't have to breathe to live, but of course they still do in order to speak or even out of habit. We've also learned that their bodies remain identical to how they were turned forever.
Yeah.
So Eddie, the vampire, talks about how he can't lose or gain any weight. However, it does seem that hair grows, comes and goes. Lorena has a lot of different lengths. We sometimes see 5 o'clock shadow on Bill, depending on, you know, what he's been up to.
Yeah, I was, you know, so a lot of these things as a series goes, right? We have to do stuff.
Yes.
Right. We just have to do stuff to make the story work.
Yes.
And getting rid of Alex's wig, Eric's
wig, was of utmost priority.
It was of utmost priority. And I think Alex mentioned, he did say in the commentary that, you know, wigs itch.
Yeah, they're not comfortable necessarily. And it's one thing to ask an actor in a movie to wear a wig, you know, every day for
months. 3 months or something.
Or to keep their hair exactly the same for 3 months. You know, that's, you know, a sort of necessary sacrifice in that way. But we're talking 7 years.
7 years.
People's lives, and they are doing other jobs, and they, you know, have to change their look for things. And it's just, no matter how hard one tries, it's very hard to remain exactly the same for 7 years.
Yeah, it's very hard. And so I guess Pam just cuts Eric's hair every morning.
Yeah.
I'm just remembering in his making flashback with Godric, I don't remember his hair.
He has the longer hair. See, I don't think Pam cuts his hair every morning. I think when a vampire cuts their hair, it grows like normal human hair. I think their beards grow like normal human hair. I think it's just that I think True Blood just decided at a certain point that that was easier lore than trying to say anything else.
Fair enough.
Yeah, and I think that works fine. You know, again, part of that speech that Bill gives is that this is all magic and mystery, and we can kind of accept and move on, which is lovely. So in terms of regeneration, vampires do have this super healing that they can do. So we'll start. I've got, you know, the good, the bad, and the utterly embarrassing that we'll talk about today. So we'll start with the good, which is Eric and the Silver. So we see Eric heal from Silver this episode.
Yeah. And I'm thinking of many things I can't say yet, because over the 7 years, right, we saw Silver, and audience, you can kind of help us track this, because you will see Silver
change
where in the beginning it's like a little bracelet and we're incapacitated.
Yes. Versus now Eric's got quite a hefty silver chain on him.
I have one thing I need to say about this, because clearly Eric doesn't watch the show, because He lets them silver him.
I know.
And then tries to negotiate.
I know. It's, well, you know, I guess we're meant to believe that, you know, he's sort of sacrificing himself so that they will hopefully let Sookie go or whatever. You know, he has
no choice. Shouldn't he say, look, I will let you silver me if you let Sookie go. Yeah, then they let Sookie. But I guess we needed Sookie to stay in the room.
We need Sookie to be there.
So he says, silver me.
Yeah.
And then he tries to bargain and then they go, no. And I'm like, does he not watch the show?
He has no bargaining chip. I did have a thought about the silver. And I did wonder, mm-hmm. you know, we do have this thing about age that the older a vampire is, the stronger they are, the more powerful they are. So there is a world in which little baby mm-hmm. Bill, who's only like 200 years old or so, not even really 150 years old, that little baby mm-hmm. Bill could maybe be kept down by a tiny little piece of silver, a little strand. Whereas Eric, at 1,000 years, might need a heftier chain to kind of really take him down.
So, yes.
So there
I can
is
go with
that. Yeah, there is that.
Mm-hmm.
So next mm-hmm. I've got the bad, which is, I'm going to say, Lorena and the plasma TV.
Yeah.
Because she's knocked out. And I got to say, there's a part of me that went, I'm not so sure vampires could be knocked out. That is an interesting take.
Uh-huh.
And I definitely noticed it. Yeah, I suggest we look out for that in future episodes because that does feel like, especially with an older vampire like Lorena, that's asking a little much, which is fine. You know, you have to do what you have to do.
Well, I liked in the commentary, of course, everything sounds better in an English accent, but how Stephen was saying,
yeah,
you know, they were wondering how to get Bill out of the room.
Yeah, they have to
get him
out.
So Alan was like, well, just hit her with a plasma.
And
you know,
so they did.
That's how you get someone out of a room away from a really old vampire. Yeah. Of course, you just hit him over. And then they used a bowling ball and dropped it on the TV to show that dent.
But he's right? I mean, they set up this impossible situation.
Yeah.
And they had to get him out of there. And I like that they use Barry the Bellboy as a distraction. Mm-hmm. I think that was a really helpful way to do
That's a smart plant for the future as well. Because she says, what are you?
Yeah.
And it tastes different.
It'll lead to Sookie and all of that stuff coming up. You know, but that's definitely one where I marked it and went, I want to track vampire consciousness, unconsciousness as this series continues. And then finally, we have
your hymen.
Utterly embarrassing, which is
Jessica's
hymen. You know, beyond the sort of clickbaity feel of it all, I actually think it's sort of interesting for Jessica as a metaphor.
It is.
And it is logical with what they've set up. They certainly didn't have to shine a storyline on it. But it does in a weird way work, I think. You know, because I think for her, having lived with no freedom in that household, and then suddenly it's like vampires, suddenly I get to have all this freedom and I get to have sex and I get to, you know, be wild and free. And it's like the cage door sort of slamming down again and holding you back and saying, you can't ever grow up. You can't ever be a woman.
Right.
And even though we know that that's not true, you know, for a young person in that moment, it would be very, very difficult, I think, to sort of move past that right then.
That's a difficult one.
Yeah. And I like, too, that, you know, we have this idea that immortality and eternal youth is this wonderful thing. And wouldn't you just love to be 17 forever? And, you know, this isn't really, it isn't all that it's cracked up to be.
Yeah. And it does make me think of Anne Rice's character, the young girl, the child, right? You know, and Raelle Tucker, I think, was the one they said came up with this in the writer's room or proposed it. And then Alan thought about it and went for it because, again, it adds inner conflict, outer conflict. I mean, it just adds a layer of difficulty.
Yeah. What it asks us this question of, like, aging and how much of that is internal, how much of that is external. You know, at some point, she's going to have been a vampire for 20 years and she will have the mind of a 47-year-old. You know, what does that do to someone? How do they process that?
That inner and that outer.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's such it's a really wonderful tool that they used. You know, I thought it was sweet in the commentary that Steve was talking about you. Everyone was talking about what a wonderful actress you are. And Stephen was saying that you got a direction at some point to play something more innocent, like my life has been taken away from me. And suddenly Stephen felt paternal feelings about Deb. Right? Like he really was like keyed into that kind of, suddenly he said she felt like my daughter.
Yeah.
And then he said Deb can do no wrong in my opinion.
Aww. Well, that's subjectivity, you know.
I know, but isn't it beautiful?
It is lovely. And, you know, and I think that's always a fun thing to talk about and let people in on at home. You know, while Steve and Bill are different people in my eyes, and, you know, there are essences of these relationships that you play that paint a little bit the way that you feel about, you know, the actor. And you know, at the end of the series, I always used to say, you know, I'm sad. I know I will keep in touch with Steve. I know that we will continue to correspond and be friends, but I will never see Bill Compton again, right? Like, I will never get to interact with him. And so there's a weird parallel and separation that's happening. So I also felt a kind of role model looking up to Steve in a certain way. You know, he never quite felt like my peer. He always felt like a mentor a little bit in that way.
Right.
Yeah.
So, well, you know, we can borrow from those feelings and then use them, and then they grow.
Yes.
Right? Because we're stoking those flames for 7 years.
Absolutely.
And then, so it is an interesting relationship.
And when, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about proximity in acting and using physicality, you know, your body doesn't know you're acting, which is a great actor's tool, right? But, you know, when you spend all day doing a fight scene where you're yelling at each other and you're crying and you're upset and you're doing it dozens of times, you know, your brain knows. But at the end of the day, your body is exhausted, like you've been
fighting. Your body is exhausted and a little confused.
And so as we enact these things, again, even though your mind has one foot in this is fiction and one foot in, you know, accepting it as reality in order to be an actor, your body's kind of more in that latter camp.
Right.
And so, they color each other.
Yeah, that's really well put. I have thought, like, when I've played out a rape scene or what have you, you know, difficult being beaten, I have thought it's really bizarre and interesting and that there is a line between being in control and not being in control, and that they're creating it and being the effect. So the fact that I'm generating and creating and choosing this experience makes the perception on all levels of the experience completely different. You know, not as damaging, right?
Yes.
Not damaging. In fact, can be sort of cathartic living it out when you're the creator, you know. But it is a fascinating world to step into on all your different layers and parts of you, these crazy things like that fight scene between Tara and Eggs.
Absolutely. One, you know, it goes into, you know, this is another one of those scenes that Jim and I rehearsed extensively and discussed extensively. And this is one of the ones where we were like, if you can give it to us, we would like time on that set to figure out where to sit and, you know, what in the room is going to affect that and things like that. And some of that is, you know, that wasn't Jim and I getting together to like make out outside of school, right? It was the opposite.
Right.
It was us saying, what are your boundaries? What are you comfortable with? What am I comfortable with? Because if I'm in the moment of the scene going, is it okay if I run my hands through his hair? Is it all right if he touches me around my waist? Now I'm not in the moment, right? And I can't live fully in the story of falling in love with Hoyt Fortenberry. But if Jim and I walk through it in a very clinical, open, respectful way and say, here's where I'm comfortable and here's what I think might happen in this moment. Is it okay? What do you think? This moment doesn't feel organic. What could we do differently? I'm struggling with this. And we get to kind of free ourselves up so that action to cut can be entirely this emotional, imaginative experience. And we can genuinely fall in love with each other in that moment and know exactly as you were saying that we are both safe, that we are both in control. And that I think is so important. And it doesn't matter what your lines are. Your lines can be, you know, very permissive or, you know, whatever feels right to you, or they can be less so. But it's just about having shared that conversation openly. And again, I think to have had someone like Jim at the beginning there, who wanted to do that work, meant that this could be such a great story and we could both really feel safe telling it. So now we're going to introduce to you Michael McMillan, one of my favorite people in the world.
Yep.
He was such a dear friend during the making of this show. He and I spent time outside just as friends, going to concerts and supporting each other's work. And we've both done his podcasts. He's just a really special person, an incredibly talented actor, and one of the sweetest and funniest people I know.
Ditto.
Hey,
Michael!
I'm so excited to see you.
I like that you guys like pop out from behind a virtual couch, basically.
Oh, hi! It's so good to see you.
So
yes,
good to
thank
see
you
the
so
both
much
of you.
To talk. Yeah.
Thanks for having me. Come on, this is great. I'm so excited.
Your performance as Steve Newland and the story that Steve gets to tell really is a highlight of every episode. I mean, I have to say, this has been one of the most fun characters to research.
Yes.
Like going through YouTube and just finding, like every scene makes me laugh.
Thank you. That's so nice to hear. I mean, obviously, I had so much fun doing the show. I mean, this show doesn't come around again. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like this was a really unique experience in my career. And to this day, I mean, I've always found something that I've loved on everything that I've done for the most part. But True Blood and playing Steve Newland, I mean, that this is really probably my favorite character so far, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many to many of the roles here. There're just so many levels to these characters and so many places to approach. And the thing that I loved about working on True Blood was it would bounce from the absurd to the deeply troubling and then deeply moving from moment to moment. I think the thing that everyone who watched the show connected to was this, the unpredictability of where things were going to go at any given moment.
As far as I'm concerned, the Newlands are like the greatest villains of this series.
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
I mean, they sort of are designed that way in the DNA of the show, because if you have... Yeah. If the premise of the show is an allegory for people who are minorities, people who are in groups that are attacked, it's so shocking to me. We were sitting down to do this and I was like, my God, things have not changed in the past 10 years. And in fact, they're getting worse. I mean, I feel like the Newlands are more relevant now, sadly, in 2022 than they were back in even 2012 or 2000.
Frankly? The Newlands are more open-minded. I was watching some of your Praise His Light stuff, and there's a guy who comes on who ends up, he says like white power at the end, and Steve Newland's remarkably uncomfortable with that.
And he's talking about Mexicans at the border.
Yeah, and Steve is not into
and
it.
And Steve is even shocked and like, oh dear. He goes, what does he say after the camera stops rolling? He says something, because like, it was like, holy breadbasket or something, you know, really.
Yeah, it's fat. I mean, that's the thing is like they are sort of designed to be, because they are they're really the voice. They're the personification of hate on the show. And I think with those moments that you're describing, I think then, and I think the thing that you're pointing out that's changed is back then when we were doing the show, I think a character like Steve was like very hyper aware of branding and not saying the quiet thing out loud. Now, obviously, that's changed. Now you're absolutely you are totally allowed to say the quiet thing out loud, and there's no ramifications.
I love Steve. I think it's the scene where there's your father up on the wall, and you're having dinner with Ryan and Anna, and he says, "We're forming an elite spiritual army." Like those two words together are so amazing.
Yeah,
called the Soldiers of the Sun. And Jason, we need you. God needs you. But I find it so fascinating, and I've had this too, in fan interactions where you talk to people who probably would want to go to become a soldier of the sun, but they love your character, but they love the show. Did you, right, where you're like, you realize that that's like not
an endorsement of that philosophy. Yeah, it's actually sort of sending it up.
We're the bad guys and we're satirizing this.
We're actually
sadly,
satirizing
it's beyond
this.
That point now.
Yeah. Now, did you have any, because when I said Republican, I got death threats.
Wow.
Did you have any? Yeah, quite a few, actually.
Yeah, I didn't. I really didn't. I expected there to be more of that kind of stuff. And there really, mm-hmm. there really wasn't. And I'm just wondering if it's because it either went, we either sold it so well that it just went right over people's, you know, I think there's
I think
a difference
right,
when, I think part of it is actually that, like, if you're playing a character who's like straight out calling someone a Republican, then they're like, mm-hmm. hey, wait a minute, that character hates me. But if you're right. playing a character that's subversive and sort of satirical and never really come, you know, never right. says you should hate me because I'm an idiot or you shouldn't like me because I'm stupid or whatever, you know, just,
right.
just I'm using base language here as an example.
Yeah.
I think sometimes they just watch a vampire show and yeah. the subtext goes right. And that's fine. That's a perfectly yeah. good way to watch a show. A lot of people yeah. watch this stuff to escape, you know, and
well,
aren't.
And I'd like to throw out there as well, you know, that one thing I've always loved about our villains is even in their most mustachey twirly moments, there's, you just get such strong sense of a personal motivation with everyone.
Yeah.
This isn't just about world domination. It's not just about, you know, that's all there. But, you know, I, to this day, still don't really feel like I know who Steve Newland is. Maybe that's because Steve Newland doesn't know. But it always felt like he was playing at something to the uh-huh. specifically whoever he was talking to. And his journey was maybe to find a bit of himself. But there's something to that, that because there was this sort of mysterious, enigmatic, soft core to
yeah.
him, it made him fascinating. And I yeah. couldn't
Thanks.
Just hate him or well, just think he was stupid or, you know.
I have yeah. two thoughts. One, I want to respond to that, but I also want to pick up on something you said about the villains and the villains yeah. not, you know, having layers. I also think the same goes for the good guys, right?
Yeah,
on True Blood.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. I always kind of had a problem, even though I've just sat here and talked about how Steve represents the far right and all this stuff, which obviously he does. I always kind of had an issue, not issue. I kind of had a problem with the one-to-one allegory for vampires and minorities or vampires uh-huh. and the queer community because Steve was also right about a lot of shit mm-hmm. that vampires were doing. They weren't. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. completely across, you had your bills, but you also yeah. had, like, Eric does some really horrible stuff. Pam
Bill
does some
also
horrible.
Killed the most people in season yeah. two.
Well, there you go. Yep. So, like, right. vampires do pose a threat in the way that mm-hmm. minority groups in this country don't. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
yeah,
I never thought it was a real one-to-one allegory. And I actually think, you know, sure. I do think Alan was obviously aware of that. I remember when we shot the church yeah. scene, he was like talking to the group extras who were in the congregation and Alan was like, okay, so this guy represents this, you know, he says vampires are bad. And Alan even said this to you, he's like, and you know what? Some of them are, they really are. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I remember yeah, yeah. hearing him say that and going, okay, but that always gives me something to hold on to is Steve because mm-hmm. there is a danger there. There is some there. They right. vampires will kill humans. So mm-hmm. it's not quite a one-to-one. And then I think that allows room in those moments where Steve to be like, well, now, you know, we're not going as far as saying that we're white nationalists here. You know what I mean?
Right.
I think that gave me wiggle room to where the hate, I think hate is too far. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That there is some common, you know, some common sense rules that we can approach with like interacting with vampires maybe here, but, mm-hmm. but he wasn't 100% right, but he, I hate saying this, mm-hmm. but he makes some good points.
Totally.
Well,
right. I hate saying
the
that.
Point being
right.
that like that Nan Flanagan was just as much of a hypocrite
yes.
as Steve Newland is.
Right. Oh, you know? Yeah.
Right.
That,
yeah.
that it's That's more about our forward face versus our reality.
Exactly. And I right, think right. in the script for episode one, when they describe Nan, when Alan describes Nan Flanagan, it says the more she looks like Ann Coulter, the better. You know what I mean?
Right.
So
right.
so both mm-hmm. sides are sending up extremists on, yes. on you know, on both sides mm-hmm. as well. So I wanted to make that point because, you know, I don't think it's a one-to-one allegory completely.
No, no, no. So I'm also curious, how did you get the part?
This is actually kind of a fun story.
Everyone has one.
Everyone has a great story about getting into this show. I love it.
It was by pure chance I even got to audition for this part.
Oh my God.
There's a world where like I was not going to be sent in to audition for Steve Newland. When I very first moved out here, I remember telling everybody, agents, casting directors, whoever, I was like, I want to be on an HBO show produced by Alan Paul. I want to be on Six Feet Under. Like, I was like, that's what I want to do. I used to watch Six Feet Under and I was like, this is like my sense of humor, my style of character acting. I totally get this. The dialogue, the right. I was like, I need that. You know, you see those shows that really inspire you as a young actor. And I was like, that's what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, 2 months into moving out here, I was up for a very big role, the role that Ben Foster eventually played on Six Feet Under.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
And it came down to me and Ben Foster. And then ultimately, I didn't get it. But word came through the pipeline that like Alan really liked my audition and really respect, you know, they were like, good job, you know.
Right.
And I was like, okay, great. I had heard that he was doing, years later, 5 years go by, and I heard that he was doing this new show about vampires. And I remember saying, I believe to my agent's manager, you know, if anything comes up for this True Blood show, like I got to go out for it. And I was working on this movie, had a very small role in an Eddie Murphy movie called Imagine That. And I was on the Paramount lot and I had a lot of downtime in my trailer. And at the time, my personal trainer, this is such an LA story. my personal trainer had access to breakdown services. So he could see all of the roles that were going out day to day.
Right.
And so he would forward them over to me just so I could be like, is there anything that they're not sending me out on?
Right.
And on this one day, on this one break, I happened to check my email and I saw the breakdown for Steve Newland. And it was from the day before. And I read the little line. It was like, Christian minister, anti-vampire, 40s. He was supposed to be in his 40s.
Whoa.
And which I am now. At the time I was in my mid to late 20s. Right. And they were like very small co-star in season one.
Oh my God.
Big recurring in season two.
Season two, yeah.
And I immediately called my manager. I was like, you have to put me up for this role. This is it. This is the thing I've been waiting for.
Oh my gosh.
I get chills telling the story. It's so cheesy. But she was like, are you, what? And I was like, Andy, put me in. They know me. Alan Ball will remember me. I know he's going to remember me. Just get me in. Get me in. So they call me back and they're like, Junie and Libby say you're not right for this.
No.
You're too young. Oh. You're not right. I was like, just get me in. I will put myself on tape, whatever it takes.
Get me in that room.
And she's like, okay. My manager at the time was like, all right, let me call him back. So she calls me back and she's like, all right, you have an appointment on, I think it was like, you know, Friday or whatever. You'll be reading for Alan. They just want you to know they don't think you're right for this. And I was like, great, just get me in. So I go to the casting offices and I walk in and there's only like five other guys in there. They're all older than me. There's some people that I recognize, nobody like big name. But I was like, okay, yeah, these dudes are all like 40 and above easily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The audition scene, it was actually like not really written yet. I think they'd written this mm-hmm. for the audition. And, mm-hmm. you know,
me too.
I was such a big nerd. I figured out what books Steve Newland was in. So I read, like crammed the second book and I found the scene. I was like, oh, they kind of lifted the scene right out of the book and put it in the script. So I was like, okay, I know exactly where this is happening in the story. It's when Sookie comes to investigate the Fellowship of the Sun Church and she sits down and has this interview with Steve. And so I come in and I do the, Alan stands up, smiles, says, hi, how have you been? I was like, I knew he would remember me.
Yes.
And I was like, I'm great. I'm so happy to be here. I'm so excited to read for this. I love this character. And he's like, all right, well, let's just get into it. So I sat down, I read it, I did it once. Alan goes, I love all that intensity. I love everything you're bringing to it. Just do it one more time and smile through the whole thing.
Oh.
Don't drop your smile. And I was like, and I remember telling him, I was like, I love that. I love that.
Brilliant.
I love it. I was like, done, you know?
Yeah.
So I did it one more time and he was like, great, thanks. And I walked out and I remember like walking across the street to Target, the Target at West Hollywood Gateway.
Yes.
And I remember walking around sort of in a daze and I was like, I think I crushed this. I think this is, I think I've got this. I got into my car and like the moment I got in the car, I got a call from my agents. They were like, you got it. You got it.
Oh my God. I could cry.
Yeah. They were like, so you'll be in season one and then they want to make you a series regular in season two. And I was just like,
oh my God.
I like, it was one of the few times that I've sat and kind of like cried tears of joy. Cause I was just like, it was such a payoff after, you know, the mirror, near miss of 6 feet under and then like working out here for 5 years. And then just the fact that I so easily would never have gone out for that part had I not seen those breakdowns.
Right. You know,
so just
crazy.
It all really, it really did feel very, divine. It's really the one role that I was like, this one felt like it was meant to be.
Right.
You know?
Wow. And that you had the confidence and
persistence, right?
Persistence to even go against the casting directors, your agents and managers who were sort of saying, maybe in the next one. But you knew.
Yeah,
and Alex Wu told me later, he was like, we all thought you were not the pick, but Alan was the one who's like, he's the guy. I'm telling you, he's the guy.
It makes me think too, then, you know, what, because that was the other thing I think with True Blood that really amazed me is sort of how flexible they were, how it felt like things shifted depending on what we as actors brought to the role.
Yeah.
So I even look at that, even just from your audition, if they were imagining someone in their 40s, how many just little shifts they made to just make it suit you so that you could do the best job you could. And then everything that you brought that then said, hey, maybe he's not just a season two series regular. Maybe he comes back again and again and again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with you. I think the writers were really, and I think this just speaks to like Alan's background, a lot of the writers' background of being playwrights and coming from theater.
Yes.
And watching and observing actors and doing original pieces with actors and then sort of tailoring scripts or doing little rewrites to help with those first performances of shows. One thing Alan also told me early on in season one when we shot the final season or final episode of season one where Jason's at the church and I'm doing the sermon, you know, Alan was like, you did not get along with your dad. You did not have a good relationship with your father. And I was like, cool. Mm-hmm. That was like Perfect. The one sort of backstory bit that never came out, you know, it was never written out there. But Alan was just like, he did not have a good relationship with his dad. And so that gave me something to also build from that this was, Steve was like this guy who never felt like he was going to fill his father's shoes.
Right.
Yeah. And then I think saw himself at some point trying to sort of in a succession, you know, like over on Succession, at some point, I think he was bracing himself like, I'm going to have to overthrow this guy or I'm going to have to break from this and take as many from his flock as I can to go start my own thing.
Yeah. Right.
And I think he was very unsure that he would have the ability to do that. And then the vampires handed him a gift. And he was like, this is great. They just gave me everything I wanted and every excuse to go out and persecute a group of people, you know, to gain.
Right. And a purpose.
Sarah's
the perfect partner in that, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, she behind perfect. The scenes can give every, you know, advantage that Steve needed.
I know she's the perfect wife.
This is the other thing is Anna Camp and I just clicked immediately. And, you know, I never read with Anna. So it was just sort of a gamble that we'd have any kind of chemistry.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's one of those crazy things in this business. You never know who you're going to get paired up with. And then sometimes it just works. And I think for the two of you, that is so clear. I mean, you guys are fire together in these scenes.
Steve, I want to ask you about, because...
you want to ask Steve? I mean,
you want to ask Steve?
Reverend Newman,
you
want to ask Steve? Can I ask you about God and the universe? Yes. Yeah. And what is the key to life? Steve. Yeah. No, Michael, I'm so absorbed. So you went to Interlaken Arts Academy, which I think is the most brilliant thing ever, but I'm just wondering about that you could speak about what you love about being in theater and with your people and you know, True Blood and just that creative atmosphere. It feels like the True Blood set is sort of like the paid version of what you experienced, camp. You know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. Just the most eclectic group of weirdos. Right? That's the thing that, like, Anna and I used to talk about this, and we would include ourselves. Sometimes we'd be hanging out. I'd be like, this cast, man, these actors are weird. Like, everyone is kind of weird. Like, everyone had their own... Everyone kind of had their own little mystery about them. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Everyone was so talented, so game. But then you'd also be like, I wonder what's going on in Skarsgård's head. You know what I mean?
Totally.
Like,
totally.
Wonder what's, you know, like, it's so, like, Ryan also always.
Yes.
Ryan was such just, like, funny, brilliant guy that what a walking contradiction. You know,
yeah.
I think he was so, first of all, I would be like, is this guy 23 or is he 49? I don't know. Like, I don't know how old he is.
Yeah.
Someone could have told me that he's 1,000 years old and he came here from another planet. And I would be like, I believe it. You know what I mean? Like,
that explains it.
He had such a quirky, weird sense of humor that didn't always, sometimes would make it there on camera, but off camera, he was just one of the funniest people to talk to. I was like, who are you? You look like you just walked off the Australian shores and you should be like playing some superhero on a CW show for the rest of your career. Yes. But you're one of the funniest, most specifically minded, comedic, talented sensitive. Actors that I've so sensitive,
mm-hmm.
but just, you know, I love him, man. I love that guy. I love that guy. He's one of the best people I've ever worked with.
Yeah.
Well, this is going back a little bit, but I want to ask you about Steve Newland's look.
I mean,
the hair is spectacular. You've talked about some of the inspiration. I mean, you start with these, like, the suits that make a lot of sense, but then later on you get into kind of the 90s dad sweater kind of world. So yeah, talk to us a little bit about how did that get set and how did it evolve?
It was two parts. It was Alan and then it was Audrey Fisher, our beautiful costume designer. It's funny, if you go back and watch season one, I don't have the Steve Newland hair yet. It's basically like Michael McMillan hair that they just sort of combed.
Right.
Yeah.
And I remember when I came in for the first episode of season two, Alan walked in to the trailer and was like, I want the evangelical... higher the hair, the closer to God. Yeah. He was like, I want, you know, Jim Baker. I want that kind of like evangelical Texas look.
Yeah.
And again, I was like, oh, yes. Yeah, of course. Yes. So I remember, you know, we did it and Alan was kind of, I think literally came back in, checked it when that's it, you know. So then the costume stuff, Audrey Fisher just nailed. I mean, she just knows her stuff. And Audrey, we walked in, those costume fittings were so fun, but like, you know, we were like, from the get-go, we were like, pleated pants only. Like, this guy has not gotten the flat front memo. He needs pleats. He needs these like big kind of 90s suits. He needs this big evangelical look. You know, I've always got the American flag pin, always got the Fellowship of the Sun pin. Paisley, big Paisley ties, you know, rich colors.
Yeah.
Just stuff that was really sort of that show that Texas wealth. And then I think one of the things that we talked about where I was like, I can't remember if it was her idea or mine. She might have had choices, but one of the early things was like belt buckle. I wanted a big belt buckle because I wanted something that felt Texas about the character.
Right.
So she would show me, you know, we'd get me all dressed up in this very like minister style suit. And then we would put a big ass Texas belt buckle with two cross revolvers. And I think, you know, I was like, well, this was obviously his dad's or his grandfather's. And now he wears this. And then I remember on episode 8 of season 2, when it was time for the lock-in, I had already done my fitting and I had these like weren't patent leather shoes, but they were like, there were these white loafer shoes, or maybe they might've had laces on them and they looked great. And I remember I came home and it was either that night or the next night, but a few days before we shot, I had a dream that we were shooting that scene and I looked down and I was wearing white cowboy boots. And I woke up and I either texted or called or emailed Audrey and I was like, I had a dream last night that I was wearing white cowboy boots for that scene. Is it too late? Can I get white cowboy boots? And she's like, I love it. So she found these white ostrich hide cowboy boots. And that's what he's wearing in the locker. Because I was like, this is his big moment. He's from Texas. He's got to have his, this, like, this is his, you know.
Opening night, man.
Yeah, this is opening night. He's coming out BDE swinging, you know what I mean? And he's got to have his belt buckle. And I think I had a skull and crossbones belt buckle on that one. And I had these big ass white, these awesome white ostrich cowboy boots.
Oh, my God.
This is what I fucking love about Audrey in the show is, especially because men's costume can get kind of, just put them in a tight shirt or a flannel and some jeans. Like, it can get kind of pushed aside in favor of, you know, sexying up the women. But True Blood was so specific about the male costuming, especially when it came to your character, to Lafayette.
Oh, yeah.
To, you know, I mean, it was to Jason. I mean, Jason, you could say those were just t-shirts and tight jeans, but, they weren't.
No.
You know, they were very specific. It was Shreveport football. It was the Panthers. It
and
was,
he probably tried on 15 pair of blue jeans, right?
And to find exactly the one that had the bell that was the right size to kind of, you know. So I've always appreciated that and to get the, like, again, the testimony from you. That really that much thought went into your
belt buckle,
your shoes.
And it wouldn't be like one belt buckle at the fitting, right? That's the other thing about Audrey. It wasn't like, here, we got this, we're busy. It was like, look at these five belt buckles. Yeah.
I believe I have credited her in the past, and if I haven't, I'll do it again. Like, Audrey was integral to creating that character. You know, getting very nerdy theater here, like in the classical French sense. Like, Audrey was really good at dressing the characters as their clowns. You know, the things that, like, the costumes that really inform who they are and empower them.
The pantalone, not just the
You take away those costume elements for those characters. You take that scarf off of Lafayette's head. You take, like, that leather jacket off Pam. You take the sweater off Steve Newland. It immediately changes who they are, right? It doesn't feel complete.
Yes.
And really, I mean, that's the beauty of our costume designer, Audrey Fisher, who we praise all of the time. But it is also in the actor's hands, right? You have to see that sweater and know Steve Newland so well, and then somehow bring those two elements together. So I think some of that credit goes to you, too.
Michael, I just want to talk to you all day. So before we wrap up, I have one more question. When you think of your experience on True Blood, are there three words that come to mind?
It was world building for me as a person, absolutely. Not just like, my world grew doing that show.
Wow. Yeah.
Just the people I met, the ideas that went in my head, thinking about the show, the way I looked at myself, the friends I made. Yeah. It was also terrifying at times, you know? I didn't want to let, like, Alan Ball or HBO down, you know what I mean?
No, me too.
And just, I think, love. I mean, I love, you know, I don't, it's so stupid, but, like,
no.
It was the most lovely experience I've ever had. Lucky in love on that show. You know, I don't know. Like, I'm just like, I'm sitting here thinking, I'm just seeing the really what it is. I'm seeing the flashes of all the people that I worked with go before my face, and, like, how lucky I was that I got to, like, there were points when, in such a big cast, I was like, well, I'm never going to work with Sam, or I'm never going to work with Kristen. And then it would always find a way. You know, I was one of those that really got lucky that I worked with almost everybody closely on the show. I just see all those faces go by that we worked with, and all the good times, and how much I just loved being there.
Well, I got to say, I mean, Steve Newland is some of the bravest work.
So brave.
In so many ways, some of the most creative. Again, for a guy who you think is one note, you touch such a spectrum of motivation, intention, need. It's so incredible. Thank you for talking to us.
Anytime.
Thank you.
If you will come back, there's so much on the horizon for Steve Newland, and we want to hear.
I'd love to. Look, you know, everybody who's worked with me on this show knows I love this show so much. I love this world. Mm-hmm. I love all the characters. I love all the creators and actors. So like, anytime, man, I'd love to come back and talk about it. It's like I said, it's one of the happiest, honestly, one of the happiest times of my life was making the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Oh, Deb.
I mean, we love all of our True Blood fellows, but there I have a particular soft spot for Michael McMillan.
How can you not? How can you not? He is just the funniest, most brilliant,
kind and easy to get along with. And I just adore him. And it's no surprise that he is an excellent podcast guest because he has two of his own podcasts, which are
and I both did
Big Collectors Club.
Yep.
Yes.
With
so
Bryce
everyone,
Johnson.
Go listen to those. It's so much fun, especially if you're into that slightly super so preternatural kind of stuff. And then you did his new one, Kristen, right?
I did Slate Your Name in season one, and so did Anna Camp. And then they're recording again, and they'll be back up in the fall. But you can listen to season one. So Bigfoot Collectors Club and Slate Your Name.
The Michael McMillan.
I mean, Michael McMillan. I mean, it's just more Michael McMillan, which none of us can get enough Michael McMillan.
This is already one of my favorite interviews. I just think he's the greatest.
Me too.
Thanks to him for coming on and talking with us.
Yes, yes, yes. We adore him.
Next week on Truest Blood, the power is shifting among the vampires, and we'll shift the spotlight to the amazing folks who make Bontemps feel all lived in. Then we'll deep dive into what it takes to be a background actor.
And the faultless Alan Hyde joins us to talk about his gripping work as Godric. It may be a short-lived role, but it will live on in our hearts. He is such a strong force in Denmark, both in front of and behind the camera. He is a true force of creativity and just wise beyond his years.
I can't wait to hear what he has to say.
Yeah.
So thanks for listening, Truebies. Subscribe and follow wherever you listen to your podcasts, and we'll see you next week.
Y'all come back now, you hear.
Got any burning questions you want answered on Truest Blood? Post them on any and all social media platforms using hashtag FangClubQuestions, and we may feature them on the show. That's hashtag FangClubQuestions. Truest Blood is produced by Safe Haven for HBO Max. Executive producers are Janina Gavankar, Kristen Bauer, and Deborah Ann Wool. Our producer is Gabrielle Galan, and our audio producer is Christopher Wool. Our theme song was recorded just for this podcast by Jace Everett. Additional music was composed by Timo Chen. And remember, you can watch all of the original episodes of True Blood on HBO Max.